From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, the Mark of the Beast and End Times with Irvin Baxter. I'm looking forward to this. Well, fresh back from Washington, D.C., I had a wonderful time at the X Conference 2008. Stephen Bassett just did a phenomenal job putting that conference on with some very heavy hitter guests as they continue to look for and work on disclosure of the extraterrestrial presence. It was just a great get together. I mean, the conference was about 4 days long, and I was there for 1.5 days. And we had a great meet and greet, meeting hundreds and hundreds of you. And then, of course, the banquet dinner, which I had just a great time at. I had a chance to meet Defense Minister, former Defense Minister of Canada, Paul Hellyer, who talked about the UFO and extraterrestrial presence, talked about some pilot cases and what they had seen. It's just an incredible, incredible moment to hear a former defense minister of a country talking about the reality of extraterrestrials. And then, of course, a moment that I will never forget for the rest of my life, sitting there having dinner next to Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell, who was the main keynote speaker and was awarded a great award from Stephen Bassett's Paradigm Research Group. I got to tell you, when I got up to give my speech, I stopped for a moment and looked over the audience and said, how cool is this to be having dinner with a guy who walked on the moon, and the place just broke up in applause for Edgar Mitchell. What a great individual. And I had a great time. They gave me an award for what we've been doing on Coast to Coast, trying to seek the truth. And, of course, that award dedicated for you, Art Bell, for starting this program. Onward with some news of the day before we get into our guest for this hour. My, oh my, almost like Al Capone's days in Chicago, an epidemic of gunfire rattled the city during the weekend with at least 32 people shot, 6 killed. The weekend shootings were scattered all over the city there. Police said they included gang shootings, drive-by attacks, and even one case in which someone used an AK-47 to shoot up a plumbing supply store. Heavy gang influence there in Chicago. A Georgia military contractor tricked law enforcement agencies into buying faulty stun grenades, ultimately leaving 3 FBI agents injured. Pyrotechnic Specialties is accused now of relabeling and selling flashbang grenades that the U.S. military rejected after its personnel were injured. The indictment alleges that the company officials bribed a federal official and paid for a visit to a strip club. The officials are accused of conspiracy, money laundering, mail fraud, and defrauding the government. The company did not immediately respond to calls. Just hours after former President Jimmy Carter trumpeted Hamas's agreement to let Israel live as a neighbor, that same terrorist leader he met with face-to-face vowed not to recognize the Jewish state. But the Hamas leader, Khalid Mashal, did offer Israel a 10-year truce if it withdraws from all lands it seized in the 1967 Arab-Israeli War. Carter met twice with Mashal over the weekend. In Minnesota, the Sibley County Sheriff says that a man who accidentally shot and killed his 9-year-old son while they were hunting apparently mistook the boy for a turkey. In Florida, beach patrol officials say a shark nipped a 14-year-old's right foot while she was surfing. Captain Scott Peterson says the girl has cuts and puncture wounds. Otherwise, she's okay. In Michigan, an inmate with a peanut allergy has died after eating a peanut butter sandwich at a jail. The sheriff out there said, hey, the inmate didn't mention peanuts when he was asked while being booked whether he had any allergies. An English student has spoken out about her rare phobia, a paralyzing fear of buttons. Jillian Lincoln, she's 22 years old, can't even stand to be in the same room as friends and family who wear them. The sight of buttons, she says, sends her into panic attacks. Our Lady's Children's Hospital, the largest child hospital in Ireland, has admitted removing the wrong kidney from a patient during surgery. The Dublin hospital did not release details of the child's age, gender, when the operation took place for reasons of privacy. This is happening way too often. Somebody goes into the hospital to have an operation on a leg and ends up getting her colon removed. In a moment, Dr. Alan Hamilton joins us as we talk about these hospital nightmares. Later on, we'll take your phone calls. You might have a story or two to share with us right here on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Alan Hamilton, the Executive Director of the Arizona Simulation Technology and Education Center at the University of Arizona's College of Medicine. He's also a professor in neurosurgery as well as radiation oncology and psychology. Currently, Dr. Hamilton has created and is the director of a think tank using doctors and computers to research and simulate medical mistakes and find remedies. He's our guest this hour on Coast to Coast, Dr. Alan Hamilton. Alan, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, George.
You are, of course, noted author of the book, The Scalpel and the Soul. And I've got to ask you, these botched surgeries, how do they happen?
Well, one reason they happen is, first off, the patients are moving through the system faster and faster, and the doctors are drilling down, so to speak, on the patients more and more. They're not necessarily seeing the patient consecutively. They're meeting once, booking the surgery. The patient comes into the operating room. They're prepping the area and then suddenly going and doing the surgery, and there's not necessarily a complete sense of the patient's picture anymore. And this is what happens is, physicians and surgeons get pushed more and more into a technician's role as opposed to taking care of the whole patient, having a history, going over the laboratory's values, and so on.
Now, by and large, Dr. Hamilton, these doctors are qualified doctors. They're good doctors. They're good hospital facilities. I guess there's something wrong here.
There is. In fact, if you look at, for example, the aviation industry, in the last 20 years, the fatalities from aviation accidents has gone down about 30%. If you look in medicine, the mortality from what we call medical adverse events, mistakes, has gone up 200%. And part of the reason for that is the patients are moving through the system much faster, much more acutely. We're discharging patients much, much faster than we ever used to. We're sending them home early. They're coming in on the morning of surgery or the afternoon of surgery. So there's much more shorter time that they're in the system. And then last but not least, there's just a general overall hustle and moving patients into ambulatory settings more, where, again, their transit time is much, much shorter and the chances of a mistake get much higher.
Do we need to worry about these medical errors when we go into the hospital?
Absolutely. Medical adverse events now is the fourth leading cause of death in the United States. Five times more people will die this year, conservatively will die this year than die on the highways of America from medical mistakes.
Alan, will a doctor be offended if, let's say, we're going in to get a kidney replaced and you say, "Doc, it's over here. It's this one."
George, it's exactly the opposite. What patients need to do, and it sounds so silly when I tell you this, but this is what we tell patients to do. For example, if you're having your right knee operated on, literally you say, X here, this is the right knee. This is the one you operate. And on the left side, you go, not here, the other knee. And it sounds stupid, but because wrong side surgery is so common, we literally recommend that patients and their families take this precaution and mark the side that the surgery is supposed to be on, because very often they're under anesthesia. And there can be, somebody said, "Well, I think it was the left side," and they position everybody for the left side. So literally we tell patients, mark the hip, mark the knee, mark the foot. It sounds silly, but do it.
I have had in the last couple weeks, Alan, stories worldwide, not just restricted to the United States, of these botched operations, from surgical instruments being left in someone and he's stitched up and they find out a year or two or 5 years later, maybe even longer because he's got incredible stomach pain. There was one guy who had a pain for 20 years. And then there was a woman who went in for leg surgery and they ended up rebuilding her rectum. I mean, my God.
These are terrible accidents. And what you're talking about, I wish I could say they were isolated, George, but they're not. As you say, they're happening all around the world. Because America has one of the biggest healthcare systems, they're happening with a lot of frequency in the United States. Now, there are a lot of things people are trying to do. They've even gone so far as having a robotic counter. Literally a robot that counts the instruments and keeps count of them all through the case. So it's almost like a computer, and it's saying, you know, you ordered, you know, five bottles of apple juice and there's only four in the grocery bag. It literally is doing the same thing with hundreds of surgical instruments and going, you know what, we're short one instrument, you better look. It's very common now to make instruments and sponges and other things have X-ray markers. So that if what we call a count at the end of the case, they literally count the instruments and count the sponges and so on. If that count is off, it's mandated that you examine the patient and look for these X-ray markers to find them. But it still happens, and it's obviously terrible, as you say, for a patient to have pain for 5 or 10 years and then find out that there was an accident and a whole surgical instrument was left behind.
The child in Ireland who had the wrong kidney removed. Now, what can you do? What's the medical recourse there? I mean, can they put the good kidney back on and then take the bad one out?
No, what happened here is the child had one bad kidney and one good kidney. They meant to take the bad kidney out. By accident, they removed the good kidney. This child basically now has no kidneys, and this child is on dialysis until such time as a suitable donor could be found. And then, of course, the child's going through a kidney transplant with all of the worries. Although kidney transplants are a very common operation now, there still are chances of rejection, of not finding the right donor, of having complications from dialysis. So this child is basically going to be doomed to be on a kidney machine until the suitable donor is found.
Why can't they put the original kidney back in?
Probably because they did not realize they had removed the wrong kidney until it was too late to transplant it. Had they realized it right away, you're absolutely right. It would have been a relatively easy thing for the surgeons to reattach the kidney. But my guess is from the story that they only realized way after the surgery that they had removed the wrong kidney.
Does the organ die if you don't put it on ice quickly?
Yes. It'll no longer be suitable unless the appropriate steps are taken to preserve it specifically for transplantation, which will make it last much longer.
I got to believe, Dr. Hamilton, lawyers are jumping up and down on cases like this.
They are. And the issue comes up, well, you know, we hear so much about lawyers and medical malpractice and how it's driving up the cost of medicine. But the truth of the matter is, and this is staggering, less than 2% of the medical errors that occur actually ever go to litigation. So 98% of them never even get into the legal system. So you sort of have to really question that specific statistic. But I'm sure the lawyers, as you say, are all over this, because there's obviously been irreparable damage done to this child. And this child is basically going to have to live for the rest of the life with having its natural kidney no longer available and using a donor kidney at best.
I got to tell you, all the money in the world wouldn't satisfy me on something like that if it happened to my kid.
And you know, there's worse. I mean, people have been killed by accident, paralyzed by accident, maimed by accident. And as you say, there's no amount of money in the world that can really correct that or make up for what happened. So it's really a poor remedy for the actual people who are suffering.
How severe is the problem? Because I would guess, as you've just pointed out, that a lot of these cases and these issues get worked out behind closed doors very quickly. They probably get settled before they even get to court or trial. So we don't really know about them. How many more are there out there?
Well, there are a lot. There are some things that get settled behind closed doors, as you say. For example, the review that's done by doctors is basically called peer review, meaning it's reviewed by your peers. And that's an internal review. It's closed to the outside. A lot of the remedies that are looked for in the hospital will happen through that mechanism. And then, as you also said, many times the hospital itself or the physician will come forward and say, there's been a mistake made. We admit the mistake. We are going to do everything we can to make it up for you. We realize there may be some damages and so on, and people will just reach some agreement. And then there's that, you know, that percentage that's going to actually go on to litigation and potentially into the courts.
Tell me what you've been working on, Alan.
We've been looking at, for a long time, at how pilots are trained. Now, when we get on a plane, we don't knock on the cockpit. Well, we're not allowed to knock on the cockpit door anymore. But if we don't go and say to the pilot, hey, tell me how many of these planes you've crashed before. You know,
right.
So the point is the pilot knows how to handle every contingency, but we're not basing this on a trial and error experience. So we've looked at this. And we now have computerized mannequins who are patients. We can make them any age. We can give them heart defects. We can give them different diseases, smoking, heart disease, whatever you want. And then we can actually take people through a whole variety of scenarios, a drug overdose given by the physician. We can misdiagnosis, delayed treatment, an error in technique. We can do all of these things on the mannequin. We can do them over and over and over again. And very often, it's surprising sometimes the simplicity of the remedy. We did an exercise with some residents where they had a medical emergency, and one of the things we found was that they were waiting on an average 7.5 minutes before they asked for help. So one of the things that we built into this trial, this teaching exercise, is wait a minute. One of our goals is that you call for help within 30 to 45 seconds. And that's and it seems like a very, very simple thing, but it makes a huge difference to the patient that the medical team gets there promptly.
Oh, I bet it would. And, you know, I guess that there's nothing. Yeah, I've been flying a lot lately over the last couple of years, and there's nothing worse than thinking about getting sick on a plane, whether it's serious or not. That's just a place you don't want to get sick, is it?
Well, the plane is there's such limited resources, and you know, especially on these longer flights, you know, trans-Pacific, Hawaii to California, transatlantic. When you're in the air up there, and something goes wrong, there are defibrillators, there's oxygen, there's some relatively simple things they can do, but obviously that pilot and that flight crew has to find the fastest route to getting you down on the ground, and that may be hours away. And so that can be some very difficult, tense times. And I've had two occasions where, you know, the flight attendant asked over the public address system on the plane, you know, do we have a doctor on board? And, you know, you have a full-blown emergency to try and handle with a minimum amount of equipment.
Have we ever had a case where the pilot and co-pilot died accidentally on a plane while flying it? Not a crash, not an act of terrorism, where, because I do know that a pilot or co-pilot has died on a plane, but have they ever both gone?
Not that I'm aware of. You know, one of the reasons they build redundancy into this system, and they have the mandate for a pilot and a co-pilot, is just to cover you know, that possibility, even something to the point of where one of the pilots becomes so ill they can't fly. But I don't know of a situation where just from accidental natural causes, both members of a crew have been struck, and obviously for transatlantic flights, the crews are bigger. So there's even more redundancy built in for the longer legs.
I've even seen now where if the pilot or co-pilot has to come out and use the restroom, that a flight attendant goes in and replaces the pilot or co-pilot, locks the door, and they stay in there until that pilot comes out of the restroom and safely knocks on the door.
You know, all of the rules about cockpit presence now have changed. All the rules are changed after 9/11, and your people are aware that pilots are very leery and very careful about now when they come out of that cockpit.
Yes.
Any vulnerability for the whole cockpit area. So it is much more tightly regulated than ever before. They're very careful about letting people, gather up in the galley areas or the rear of the plane in the galley areas, especially near the cockpit.
Alan, stay with us because we're going to keep you for phone calls. I'd like you to call us. Questions for Dr. Alan Hamilton, or share those nightmare hospital stories with us. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, Irvin Baxter joins us as we talk about end time prophecies. It's been a while since we talked about that, so I'm looking forward to talking with Irvin in just about a half hour right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Dr. Alan Hamilton. Alan, the book, The Scalpel and the Soul, still available to people?
Yep, it is.
What's the best place to get it?
Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble's, your independent bookstore. It's everywhere right now.
Super. Let's take some phone calls. You ready?
Yep.
Pick it up by going to Dennis, driving around in Michigan. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi, Dennis.
Hello, George. I love your show.
Thank you, Dennis.
I drive a truck, and you keep me safe on the road, so I appreciate it.
Okay, go with your question, Dennis.
When I was younger, we had a family doctor who was a surgeon. He did a hernia surgery, tonsillectomy on me, appendectomy on my father, gallbladder on my mother. It seems like our care was so much more complete with our family doctor doing those things, and I wonder, for those few doctors who may still be doing that, is that care better? Is it more complete? Is it more thorough and effective?
Is the care more thorough than it used to be with that family doctor, Alan?
Well, I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, George, which is the family doctor has a full history and has the picture from beginning to end. And very often you're going to be a lot safer with a doctor who's known you and has a real complete picture of your health than somebody who's, I'm the surgeon, you're going to see me today, tomorrow we're going to operate, I'll be sending you home and following up with your doctor then after that. So, yes, in some ways, the doctor who's giving you the long-term care and the longitudinal care is going to be safer.
Excellent. Next up, west of the Rockies, Mike in Oregon. You're on the air with us. Hi, Mike.
Hi, George. Not so nervous. Can I say hello to America?
Of course.
Hello, America. Thank you for my disability benefits. I really appreciate it. I'm calling now as a matter of payback, so if I come off mean, please understand that's why I'm calling. And to the fellow Marines, semper fi, it doesn't mean going along with whatever they do wrong. George, I'd like to tell you what happened to me, if I could.
Yes, you may.
In 78, I joined the military very healthy. Within a year or so, I had hurt my back, and they operated twice. Both times, they missed by about 4 to 6 inches.
Oh.
Just before that, they injected this stuff called metrizamide into my back to do an x-ray, but it was bad or something went wrong. And I went blind for a little while, but nobody but me could tell. Or nobody but me believed it. And now 28 years later, the government has good and bad, by the way. I'm very grateful to the government, but they took 25 little tiny steps to turn around and admit that it wasn't all in my head. It was they injected something into my spinal cord and brain that changed my whole life, and I had to become a super expert in this whole line of field of neurology and legal stuff just to get my benefits, and now I finally got my benefits, and I'm fighting for disability benefits for 20 years ago.
20 years. They could have done it right away, couldn't they?
Yes, and it was like I was almost a seer because I kept reporting honestly what was happening, and nobody could possibly know these things would happen, but I was reporting it, like certain things happen to your body, your internal organs and stuff. And then when they did the MRI, finally, it showed all these lumps and it's called the clumping of the nerve roots, and it's incredibly painful.
Yeah, can you function, Mike? I mean, what's your life like every day?
Well, I don't work very much. I spend most of my time reclined, but I can play pretty good video games, and I think all the time, if I can refer to Mr. Hawking, he pointed out that being disabled gives you certain advantages, and I try to capitalize on that and help America get better. And I want to warn America, you do not want nationalized health care because then you'll be treated like us veterans. That's all I really had to say, Mr. Norrie, I'm so thankful.
Okay, Mike. That's a big problem, Alan, not getting the kind of treatment these vets need when they come back or something happens to them, and, you know, he's got to wait 20 years before they finally give him the proper treatment.
Well, you know, I think we all owe, obviously, Mike, a debt of gratitude, you know, as a Marine for having served the country. I think it is problematic how often veterans have to fight to get the health system and the VA system corrected. You know, I think Mike obviously fought back, and he fought long and hard. And obviously there are a lot of patients out there who would have lost hope long ago. And I think, you know, that Mike said he had to become an expert. And I think that's really the attitude that you have to take. You really have to sort of look out for yourself and really educate yourself about every aspect of your own medical care so you're fully informed.
Okay, next up, first-time caller line. You're on the air with us. Hello there. Hello?
Hello?
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Marie from Loves Park, Illinois.
Uh-huh.
And I just wanted to tell you a couple things that have happened as far as medical problems that have happened.
Go ahead, Marie.
My father has had pancreatitis. He's in the, what do you call it, critical care unit down in Florida. They had called my mother and told him that he had woke up and was telling them that he wanted to be removed from the machine that was keeping him alive. Fortunately, my brother lives down in Florida, so we told him to go and check. My father was still in a coma, but they were trying to say that he wanted to be disconnected from the machines. Fortunately, he's still on the machine, but he has come out of his coma now. And the other thing is, anybody who has ever had something called fibromyalgia,
mm-hmm.
wanted to let them know, don't let your doctor tell you that it is all in your head, because it is a very real illness. And up until just recently, the medical world hasn't even recognized that. They will do all kinds of tests on you. They will treat you like a guinea pig and put you on all kinds of drugs and never really realize that it is actually there. And God bless all the people that are on disability and stuff, but they've really got to watch out, because just this year, our government has pulled the thing of people that are on disability, they are now taxing them on their disability and on their Social Security, even though they didn't tell them about it.
Alan, how difficult is it for you, because you're basically looking at potential problems through simulation, do your peers come down on you at all, or how do they treat you?
I think most of my peers are very supportive. I think now they realize that computer simulation can help us practice. There have been some studies that have shown, for example, in laparoscopic surgeries where they put the tube in your abdomen and operate through very small openings, that practicing in a laboratory can actually reduce errors by about 30% and shorten the amount of time it takes for the surgeon, because they're well practiced and well rehearsed. So I think most people in surgery recognize that. The American College of Surgeons now is basically going to mandate that surgeons train on simulators at a certain point. So I think there's a big support for that across medical education now.
All right, east of the Rockies, Russ in Toronto, you're on the air with us. Hey, Russell.
Good morning, George and Dr. Hamilton. Russ here in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. I'd like to make comment, but also direct a question to Dr. Hamilton. And the discussion tonight is something that we up here have been involved with, the Canadian Patient Safety Institute, for example, and the Canadian Health Economics Research Association have pursued these issues for quite some time. I have of recent put forward to four federal Liberal members an interesting notion here in Toronto, and that's the creation of a hospital that would do nothing except look at state-of-the-art applications. It wouldn't serve patients except in an emergency like SARS that we had here some years ago and through legislative mandate. It would operate 24/7 and deal with every facet of hospital care and treatment, diagnosis, waiting rooms, lighting, floors, walls, etc. And if some notion came up 2 weeks down the road in terms of a waiting room, you'd pull the old one out and put a new one in. It would have a database that people could tap into in Canada and around the world, and that information would be accessed by any and all that would care to use it. And most, but I would put to you that unless we get on with state-of-the-art applications in this kind of setting, it's very difficult in a conventional hospital to, in fact, apply that. And I've also been looking at the establishment of the first ever green cards or health cards in Canada in addition to the conventional cards. So non-invasive diagnosis that's not in the conventional mode. Treatment, for example, in the way of nutraceuticals and functional foods would be applied. And I'd like to ask Dr. Hamilton what he thinks of the application of expert systems in every area, operating room, heart surgery, et cetera, so that in addition to the expertise the doctors bring to bear on the patient in terms of both diagnosis and treatment, there is that additional spark with the expert systems that have been crafted. And they're on so many different fronts that could aid and abet in that diagnosis and treatment above and beyond the medical staffing.
Okay, go ahead, Alan.
Well, Russell, first, I applaud your broad vision. There are so many aspects of medical care which we have not scrutinized in detail. Simple things from the waiting room to the way our clothing and our goods are stored. I can't tell you how many patients lose eyeglasses, dentures, jewelry, simple things that you'd think we could easily take care of. But far more importantly, the flow of patient and goods. You're absolutely right when you put your finger on the capability that we now have with what's called telemedicine, which is we can really import anybody at any moment, 24/7, into an operating room. Right now, as we speak, there are radiologists around the globe who are reading x-rays and that are experts in these x-rays and calling in their reports. There's no reason why if I'm operating and I need the best expert in the country on spine surgery to come in and take a look with a camera in the operating room light with me and say, okay, I can see what you're seeing. Let me look at the studies and let me consult with you right then and there. This would go a long way to basically making a panel of experts available 24/7, night and day, whenever a patient would need it. And, you know, that is really where the technology can bring us. We just, as you point out, unless there's a government mandate and support, how are individual hospitals ever going to be able to afford this kind of massive infusion of technology? But it's necessary. It's like saying you're not going to have a safe flight control system, for example, for the country's airlines.
It's, do you have any necessary, Alan, any specific cases of surgical instruments being left in patients that you're aware of?
Yes. I know of, if you can think of it, it's probably been left behind. I've seen at tubing. I've seen sponges. I've seen retractors, which are fairly large metallic things, scissors, hemostats. In every organ cavity, in the lungs, in the brain, in the bowels, in the leg, anywhere you can think of it, just because surgery's done millions and millions of times, almost, statistical odds, something like this can happen. You obviously can use computers, x-rays, a whole variety of techniques to try and reduce that, and that's what needs to happen.
Sarah in Brooklyn, New York, you're on the air with us. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, yes. One interesting thing is I'm a postpartum care provider. I'm a licensed lactation consultant, and okay. I've had in my office, unfortunately, numerous cases of besides sponges being left behind, but very often pieces of placenta. And if the placenta is not removed properly, a woman's breast milk will not come in. And one of the problems that I have in my practice, I want to tell you it's very interesting. After 15 years of having my own medical practice in Brooklyn, women beg and plead with me to go to births with them just so I can make sure that they're being treated properly, because you can have three or four nurses during one delivery. They have no idea whether you're strep B positive. They start administering different kinds of medications to my clients all the time with misinformation. And when I do go to births, I feel like I'm an army sergeant sitting there saying, no, she's not strep B positive. No, she doesn't have this. And it's really become a very scary scenario to give birth in America today. So much so that so many doctors were trained only in medical procedures that when a woman comes in at 8 or 9 centimeters, they don't even know how to deliver the babies properly without a woman on an epidural. So even in the simplest, I mean, I consider giving birth a non-medical problem. I consider it a natural process. People are getting in so many problems.
Well, that's true. It should be a simple procedure, Alan.
Well, I mean, Sarah brings up a great point. She's acting as a guardian angel, and she's bringing out, I think, that there's so much turnover of staff, there's so much a lack of continuity, that very often saying, I want somebody there to make sure, and, you know, this is one of the things I tell every patient, find somebody that you trust and make them your guardian angel. Make them responsible for writing everything down, taking notes when the doctors talk to you, writing down when the tests are supposed to happen. This is a vital ingredient to safeguarding against medical error.
Okay, let's go to first-time caller line. Hey, Justin, go ahead. We've got a few minutes for you.
Is this me?
Yes, sir.
All right, I was having chest pains, so I thought I was having a heart attack, you know, I'm quite young. And I went in for the EKG workup. They did the whole workup. They said, I'm not having a heart attack. They filled around and figured out I tore part of my pec off my sternum. That was my chest pains. So they gave me a shot of Phenagrin and Nubane and killed me. For 2 minutes, I was flatlined. I was dead. Mm. They did revive me, but for 2 minutes, I was dead. So I just pretty much laid there dead for a while. So I thought that was strange. So then they had to rush me to Memphis and send me to a cardiac unit to figure out what happened.
How you doing now, Justin?
Oh, well, they figured out that apparently that there's something wrong with my nervous system. So now I got a pacemaker. Something happened to me and my heart nervous system failed after they filled me full of Phenagrin and Nubane. Oh, I guess they oversedated me or something, but yeah, that was very strange to me.
You know, Alan, also, and we didn't have a lot of time to go through this, but these cases where patients aren't properly anesthetized, so they're still awake, but they can't move during an operation. Got to be a horrible thing.
It's one of the worst. You know, we were talking about training physicians, and it's one of the things that we now routinely run them through, and that is we'll ask them to go ahead and anesthetize a patient. We'll do a simulation with a robotic mannequin, and one of the things we're looking for is, are they giving the drugs in the right sequence? You're absolutely right. I can't imagine anything worse than the sense of being paralyzed but completely conscious.
I wasn't aware of this until my son had his wisdom teeth taken out because they were impacted. There, mm-hmm. A couple of them were going the wrong way, which happens. And he came out shaking like a leaf after he went under. And I said, Jonathan, what's wrong? And he went, Dad, I was awake for the whole thing.
Gosh.
And I mean, it just broke my heart. It tore me apart.
It is. And you know, what I try to explain to residents and medical students is, it's almost like a form of torture. It's the medical equivalent of waterboarding somebody, and the patient has the sense they can't breathe, they can't take a breath, but they're fully conscious. So we have to be very, very careful, and anesthesiologists try to be extremely careful at observing and making sure the patient is fully anesthetized before they're paralyzed. But as you point out, the mistake has horrible consequences for the patient who recalls all of it.
That's Dr. Alan Hamilton. His book, The Scalpel and the Soul. Up next, Irvin Baxter, End Times on Coast to Coast AM.